Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
That's right. We're Mike and Brian, and we're here to keep or kick you. In 2008, the nominees for Best Picture were The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Frost Nixon, The Reader, Slumdog Millionaire, and today's movie Milk, directed by Gus Van Sant. Here's the trailer.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
If homosexuals are allowed their civil rights, then so would prostitutes or thieves or anyone else.
40 years old, and I haven't done a thing.
I'm not going to be forced out of San Francisco by social deviants and incorrigibles.
We need one of our own in office.
We could have a revolution here.
I don't do losing.
There she is, our new campaign manager.
You all scared of girls.
You'll be the first openly gay man elected to major office.
I think you're part of the machine now.
Society can't exist without the family.
We're not against that.
Can two men reproduce?
No, but God knows we keep trying.
If these people are going to live a life of such open homosexuality, they are going to be removed from their jobs.
We're going to beat this thing. We need everyone.
We lose this, we'll have anti-gay laws in all 50 states.
I know you're angry!
Not like most homosexuals, I am.
Do you know a lot of homosexuals, Dad?
Harvey Milk will be stabbed and have a night of horror.
I'm calling the police.
They probably wrote him.
You have an issue.
It's more than an issue. This is our lives we're fighting for.
You get the first bullet the minute you stand at the microphone.
You don't have to go after that.
Life is not worth living. You've got to give them hope. You've got to give them hope.
Give me hope, Brian.
I have right here in my hand a copy of Milk on DVD, which, according to Peter Travers, is an American classic and 4 stars. It's also based on a true story.
I think you said last time that him and Ebert both gave it the number one of the year.
Right? Yeah, Ebert actually said for 2008 he was refusing to put them in order, and he just gave a whole list of 20 movies, and this was on there. But then, according to something I read later, he said that he really thought that Milk was actually number one. So he likes to have it both ways, Ebert does. Milk was nominated, one Best Actor, Sean Penn. It won Best Original Screenplay, Dustin Lance Black. And it was nominated for Supporting Actor, Josh Brolin. Director, Gus Van Sant. And Best Picture, of course. Editing Design and, or Costume Design. And then Danny Elfman was nominated for the score as well. Got a 93 on Rotten Tomatoes. Movie City News shows that the film appeared in 131 top 10 lists out of 286 critics, which was the fourth most on a top 10 list in 2008. It was made for $20 million and it made 54.6 in the box office. Coming up in this episode of Best Picture This, we'll do questions, trivia, keep it or kick it, and maybe what else you're watching.
Okay, so Anthony Quinn of The Independent, he says of Harvey Milk, "As a public figure, Van Sant does him full justice. As a private individual tormented by a needy Latino lover," that's Diego Luna, "the film is much vaguer." And that got me curious. Have you seen the Times of Harvey Milk documentary or any other? Have you read any biographies about him?
No.
Or anything like that? Neither have I.
This is mostly what I know about Harvey Milk, really.
Okay. Yeah, me too.
Which may or may not have anything to do with the truth, but they did do a lot of, you know, I think that they tried to stay pretty true to the facts.
Hmm. Okay, well, he feels very saint-like to me in this movie. So I guess what's your take on Quinn's quote here about his private life kind of seeming vague? I think I agree with that, but I don't know. I think I you know how I feel about these biopics. Yes, I do. I always want something a little bit more, more complexity. And I didn't personally get that here, but I know that you are a fan of this movie, and I'm not saying I'm not a fan, but
I don't know if I would. This is not going to be one that I'm going to keep. I didn't dislike it as much as I thought I would, because I kind of, I had the same problem with a lot of biopics, you know.
I love how that's our scale. I didn't dislike it as much as I thought I would.
They're usually predictable. It's sort of like watching a football movie, a high school football movie, you know.
Yeah.
You kind of know everything that's going to happen before it happens. I feel like, yeah, I don't know what I was really expecting as far as the complexity of the, you know, his personal life. He does seem kind of saint-like and sort of simplistic in that way, on that level. But I think that biopics are trying to do something that's usually different from what other movies are trying to do. I think that biopics are in some ways the modern mythology of our recent history. And they're not always trying to get at like they paint people in kind of a more favorable light, saying like, I'm going to make a movie about this person because I think that this person is a hero. So yeah, you're not trying to like, you know, plumb their psychological depths or anything. You're trying to show like, this person stood up against big odds and persevered and is a hero for that reason. So if I think sometimes I go into biopics wanting something more than that. Sometimes their aims are a little simplistic for compared to some of the other movies that I would say are really great art and trying to really, you know, I like complexity in the endings, and usually biopics are not very complex in the endings. They're just, and they got what they wanted and rah, rah, you know, let's keep cheering for them.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I have to always remind myself to judge it on what it's really trying to do.
It's so tough though, because if biopics in general are kind of about propping up a hero,
mythologizing,
yes, historical figures in some kind of way, I still wonder what we get out of that if we're not seeing these people as people, as flawed humans. You know,
yeah,
the whole movie long, Penn is just thumping this whole, it's not about me, it's about the movement thing. Yeah. And you know, he doesn't get discouraged and he's there for everybody. And it's just like, after a while, he just kind of feels like an idea himself.
Yeah, not really like a real person, like a real character.
Yeah. So what does that, and not that I want the movie to teach me about heroism, but what does that show me about heroism? What is that inside of people that makes them go the extra mile for a movement or for strangers that, you know, other people don't have?
I think that in this movie, that's what I liked the most about it, actually, is I did believe that he was trying to do something that was, you know, not really just about him. I don't really think that this character in this movie cared all that much about being on a city supervisor. I think that he wanted to be a symbol for, to help with, you know, gay rights.
Yeah.
It's basically like Batman.
It's exactly like Batman.
You know, he wanted to be a symbol, like Harvey Milk wanted to be a symbol.
He's so the hero
that's
that
pretty much
San
the golden,
Francisco needed.
That's basically the golden take that we needed today.
So I have some positives. I like how Van Sant uses archival footage in the movie.
Yes, I agree.
I thought that was well done.
So do you ever, when you watch archival footage in movies in general, some directors go with the actual archive.
Mm-hmm.
So you see like Richard Nixon looking like Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
In other movies, you would see Richard Nixon looking like Frank Langella.
Mm-hmm.
And here you had, I think it was mostly the real Harvey Milk, at least at the end. A lot of times they do the, you know, the actor in the pseudo archival footage during the movie, and then show you what they really look like at the end.
Yeah, which
I don't mind that either. But what are your thoughts on that approach? using the archival footage versus an actor that's like on a grainy, you know, production heavy thing that looks like archives.
I don't think that I need to be tricked. You know, I don't think that Sean Penn has to be in the clip for me to understand that it's Harvey Milk. Yeah. And I think it adds a little bit of legitimacy if it's, you know, the real guy there, and I can just connect the dots and say, all right, well, Sean Penn, I understand Sean Penn is an actor and Sean Penn is portraying this guy.
It's not a documentary.
Exactly.
He did wear a prosthetic nose.
Oh, did he?
I didn't know that until I read about it. I was, you know, apparently it wasn't a very dramatic one.
Yeah, not really.
It's no Nicole Kidman and Virginia Woolf. Nose.
Oh, God, that again. but yeah, Sean Penn, his performance, very good. And I did think that the movie was very good at sort of capturing a moment in time. You know, San Francisco during this time, you know, place and time, all good stuff. But just as a story in general, I just kind of kept hoping for it to take some kinds of chances.
You wanted a darker twist.
It's not even that I need it to be darker. It's not that I need a twist. I want some chances taken. You know, I want some experimentation in the
filmmaking or in the character building or both.
I mean, ideally both, but even if it were just the filmmaking, I could live with that. Or if the filmmaking was pretty safe, but the characterization was a little bit risky, then that's interesting too. But either way, I need something.
Yeah.
And if I don't get that, then at about the halfway mark, I just kind of feel like, okay, this is another glossy biopic. You know, I'm supposed to feel inspired. I get it. And it accomplishes that. It does. But then I'm kind of left empty at the end of it. You know, is this something I would recommend to people?
I think it is something you would
recommend. I would recommend it on a very surface level.
Yeah.
But if you ask me the same question in a few months after this movie is a little bit more of a memory,
you will forget all about it.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
So Milk, one sort of chance that he takes is I watched The Assassination of Richard Nixon. I can't remember if you said you saw it.
Years ago, I saw it.
Okay. I liked it quite a bit, actually. I think Sean Penn is really good in it. And it's, again, it's an interesting moment in history and all that. But it's kind of funny because there's a very similar device used in The Assassination of Richard Nixon, which I forget the year, but it was a few years before this. Sean Penn's character is doing a voiceover. And he has this big manila envelope that he's leaving behind. Like, if I go and kill Richard Nixon, or maybe it was a letter to Nixon, I forget.
It's like a
voiceover that, you know, if I die, then this is what you should read. And here, instead of as the assassin, he's being assassinated. And we know that early on. And he's dictating into a microphone on a, you know, lonely, dingy apartment table.
So in your trivia,
I just thought that was funny.
Was this tape real? Were these quotes
I didn't look
legit or written?
I don't know. It's a good question. But what did you think? Did that add something to you? A lot of times these voiceover frames kind of are problematic to both of us, I think. What did you think about this one?
A lot of times they are kind of problematic here. I just felt like they were using it as shorthand, so I was kind of okay with it.
Yeah.
You know, they're loading up years of history and just kind of giving us little snippets to basically say, you know, this happened and then we moved from over here. It wasn't like in the beginning of Frost Nixon where they're explaining to us why something that we're seeing is important. Rather, they're just kind of giving us connective tissue, which I think is fine.
I think in this case, that device was similar to the Frost Nixon device, but this one was more successful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'll ask a question that kind of, you know, comes out of that discussion. Todd McCarthy of Variety, he mostly liked it. He said he called the film adroitly and tenderly observed, which I would agree with. Smartly handled. Okay, whatever that means. Most notable for the surprising and entirely winning performance by Sean Penn. Then he added, while Milk is unquestionably marked by many mandatory scenes, but he, you know, praises other things about it. So it's unquestionably marked by many mandatory scenes. Were you bothered by that aspect of it? Because a lot of biopics, that's one of the big beefs, you know, that we talk about. Like, we have to get the kid. We have to get him as a kid. We have to get him as a, you know, all these different stages of life. And anytime they ever met a famous person, we got to make sure to work that in. Did you feel like that was happening in this movie?
Yeah. Not in a way that was super glaring, but it's that sort of thing where I almost feel like the whole movie is mandatory scenes in a way. I like a movie like Frost Nixon because you're looking at a guy, such a big historical figure in a way that's so out of context of sort of what he is known for. So we're seeing this little sliver of him, and then we can kind of derive what kind of person he was from that sliver instead of seeing all the important events of his life and, you know, how he coordinated Watergate or whatever. And, you know, Milk is obviously not as big of a public figure as Richard Nixon, so this story is a little less known, which maybe keeps me from rolling my eyes because I am learning something as I'm watching it because it's new.
Me too. And some of the, I think, the mandatory scenes were ones that I didn't really know about. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody who knows the story would say, oh, that's a mandatory scene. For me, I didn't really know all the figures that were surrounding him by name, and they, you know, it wasn't obvious to me. I didn't know how he was killed before I watched this movie, any of that kind of stuff. So,
and that scene is handled really well. I thought the slow motion and Penn sort of holds out his hand.
I did see it. I was like, was that cut from my ClearPlay version? But I don't think so. I think I remember what you're talking about. He holds up his hand and he gets, I think he shot a couple times or something like that.
It's just such a kind of useless defensive movement. You know, it makes it sadder that way because, you know, there's nothing you could do in that situation. And it kind of played scary real in a kind of way, even though it does have the slow motion, which heightens the style. Mm-hmm. It hit me in a certain way.
Yeah. I think that, it shows how powerless he felt throughout his life, you know, and in that moment where someone's actually pointing a gun at you, there's really nothing you can do. And so it's a pretty scary moment. And I thought it was portrayed well as well. A.O. Scott of the New York Times called Milk a marvel. And he wrote, the film is a fascinating multi-layered history lesson. I think that, he also compared it to Zodiac, David Fincher's movie about the serial killer in the 70s. I think that, again, we always come back and we have to grapple with this biopic genre, which is extremely popular. It's all over the Oscars all the time. So, you know, we get to a lot of them. But I was thinking about the biopic with, I saw an ad for Ana de Armas in Blonde playing Marilyn Monroe. And I think that the impulse for why people want biopics like Elvis Presley, you know, Elvis has just came out recently. If you're listening to this in 2022, for those in 2042, you may want to go back and look at what's going on again back in these days. But if, you know, you ask this question, it's a great date question, right? Like, who would you have dinner with if you could pick one person? Or if you could go relive one moment in history? You know, oh, I would like to be in the background at the signing of the Declaration of Independence or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or I would like to, you know, who would you like to meet in real life? I would like to meet Harvey Milk. I would like to meet Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley. These movies, these biopics essentially let you live out that fantasy. Like what would it be like to be around Elvis in real life? We can't, you know, you can't control it as much in a documentary, and some of the footage just doesn't exist. So we're going to recreate some of these moments as though you're there. And it's like, sort of like, maybe we've even used this as an example, as an analogy before, but sort of like going to a wax museum or something where you can actually go up and walk all the way around someone in 3D, you know, and see what they're really like. I think that's some of the impulse of biopics, which again is not really what I go after for movies most of the time. But if I try to think of it as like, this is a history lesson, but it's in 3D and that's mostly what it's doing, then I didn't understand before watching this movie how big of a deal that, you know, Harvey Milk was at the time. So I'm kind of glad that I know that piece of American history now.
Yeah, in that respect, you get a missing puzzle piece, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
In that respect. But then just as a piece of art, I'm always let down. But, you know, if I can learn something from it, then it's like, okay, good. And now I know that. And it's kind of in my, it's in my little knowledge box.
Whenever I watch.
Which is what I call my brain.
Oh,
my knowledge box.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's not, it's, oddly shaped for a box. But yeah, well, there's a Haley, my wife, every time we watch a movie that is anywhere based on a true story, as the ending credits are rolling, she does the same thing every time, and that is immediately goes to Wikipedia or somewhere and did that really happen?
It's funny though, you started that by saying that the biopics are extremely popular.
Yeah.
And
although this only made 54 million.
It only made 54 million.
That huge.
And I don't know, it kind of struck me because I'm wondering, are they really popular? They're tailor-made for the Oscars. They've got the prestige and they're sort of hard to dislike because they're usually always made by good directors and they star good actors.
Yeah. I mean, if you're an actor, it's sort of like, oh, I'm going to play Hamlet. Mm-hmm. Well, you have a chance to play some famous person that you know you're going to, you know, become known for, basically.
Yeah.
And have a chance to really, there's material that you can use to try to really inhabit the character. And it seems like that drives a lot of actors.
Yeah.
It drives directors. Does it drive audiences much? I don't know.
They're driven by big talent and they're usually well-crafted. Mm-hmm. So they get a lot of notoriety also because of the relevancy, you know, history, cultural, whatever. Yeah. But just thinking in my own experience, how often is it that you're talking to a friend or something like that and one of their favorite movies is a biopic, or they excitedly tell you to watch a biopic? Almost never that I could that I can remember.
You have, you know, you got the wrong friends.
I think that people don't dislike biopics.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that they love them.
They
feel a little bit disposable.
I saw somebody on Facebook recently praising Elvis. I've not seen Elvis. Baz Luhrmann. I'm not criticizing the movie, but saying how amazing the movie was, loved it. I think saw it twice in the theater already.
Hmm.
This person is probably around 70 plus years old.
Okay.
So I kind of wonder if it's somebody who is famous and from your generation, maybe there's certain attachment to it there.
Yeah.
But I bet Marilyn Monroe is a little different. I bet people from all generations would want to see that.
Yeah. And I have heard that people are sort of framing that movie as historical fiction.
Which one?
Blonde,
yeah.
Because Andrew Dominik's, that's kind of his thing. He does that with Jesse James also, kind of like flipping these mythologies on their head and using these well-known quantities like Marilyn Monroe to kind of, I don't know, talk about the culture surrounding them less than teaching us about who the person was.
It's pretty hard to separate those two unless you really know what you just said.
Yeah. I mean,
people will go into it and probably walk away just thinking that a whole lot of things really happened that didn't potentially, which is,
put a little thing before it, you know, say this is based off of true events, inspired by it and call it good.
The thing is though, I feel like there are other movies that are based on something that really happened, but they use different names and change a lot of circumstances. I respect that a lot. I'm not saying that all biopics are bad and all other movies that try to, you know, twist it but I think I respect the transparency of that. This is based on something that happened a while ago, but if you don't know that, it's okay because the movie is just good enough by itself and you don't need to know that it was kind of based on that. And it's not even said in the movie, this is based on true events. But a lot of times they are inspired by those things and they use a lot of, you know, material locations to do that.
We circle this all the time.
Yeah.
And I just think that when we enter into any fictional movie, any non-documentary, we know right away that we're giving away artistic license. And that means, you know, it could be making the historical figures more attractive. It could be making their their plot points more dramatic.
Is that prosthetic nose really, really accurate?
There's the stories are more structured. They're more linear. And in real life, it doesn't happen that way. So
this conversation happens at the same time that something else is going on. In real life, they were years apart potentially, but narratively, it's useful.
And if Harvey Milk did not record that cassette tape where he was sort of narrating his life, do we care? Is that some kind of thievery? I don't think so. Because we know that this is a construct going in. And so, you know, it's fair game.
My question is that did he write something that is very similar to that? And where did that come from? Was it a journal? Was it from testimony
if it's
of something
made up,
else?
Is it, if it's completely made up by the screenwriters, is that a problem, do you see?
I feel it's a problem. Yeah, I do. Because again, I just don't want the filmmaker to try to claim that this is a true story and then make up key facts. Or, you know, I had the same problem in Seabiscuit, if you recall.
Oh, I do.
I've complained about many of these same issues. And you always say you don't care about that.
Yeah.
But Seabiscuit, you know, it's like a David and Goliath, you know, this horse is smaller than the opponent. And in real life, it actually wasn't any bigger. The opponent wasn't any bigger. Like, I don't know. But when you're trying to claim such, you know, attention to detail, and you know that they did have a lot of attention to detail in all these movies, but then like now we're just picking a few of them to like totally, you know, twist. I don't really like that too much.
It's a dumb comparison, but
I can't wait to hear this.
Movies, I mean, real life doesn't have a movie score in the background either. And the movie score usually tells us what scenes are the most poignant and emotional and important. So because we're being manipulated by a movie score, does that make a scene untrue?
So
I don't know. There's just a very fine line between, I don't know, expecting the truth out of a fictionalized movie and then just saying, if it's not going to be 100% truth, it has to be a documentary. And I don't think that a 100% truth is ever possible. So in that case, if we're already giving away a portion, how much can we give away?
I respect quite a bit, although I didn't love the movie as a whole, but I liked the attempt of I'm Not There. Did you see that? The Cate Blanchett and many other people play Bob Dylan in very different roles, different times of life. Change the names. You know, they didn't even use Bob Dylan, but you know that like it's him represented in different ways. He's like a young black, you know, 12-year-old homeless traveling minstrel, basically, and then also Cate Blanchett in, you know, looking just like him, and very, you know, a lot of different characters in between. I feel like that is a really bold take on a biopic that is trying to, that's a place where I will say you can have it both ways there. Changing tons of stuff. A lot of it is very closely related. I mean, some of the scenes in that movie with Cate Blanchett being Bob Dylan are almost frame for frame from famous footage of Bob Dylan from other documentaries, you know, but then other times it's totally wild. So I wrestle with this a lot, partly because, so I went to grad school for creative nonfiction writing, and I spent a lot of time trying to write this true story, a memoir of me as a young journalist attempting to write a biography of a homeless man. That was my thesis. And when I was done with it, I was so done with the project. I was so fed up with it. And I was like, I need to write a novel next, because I kept getting frustrated with the ending of this story. It didn't build to a dramatic climax like I kind of wished that it would have. And I tried to like get the most out of it, that of what happened in the experiences that I had with this homeless man. But in the end, like it didn't have a flashy ending. And I was like, I want to just write a novel, because then I can come up with whatever ending I want. And I think that's kind of the wrestle that a lot of filmmakers have with biopics. You know, you're trying to tell a true story, but how do you do that and then stay as true to it as possible, but also make it entertaining? You have to just pick a beginning, middle, and end, which is already this major artistic decision. Like, why is this the end of that story? If you make one thing the end of the story, then it seems to comment on the beginning, no matter what the order was. So it's difficult.
Even who you cast is an interpretation of the person.
Yeah.
So like you were saying with I'm Not There. So I just think it's inescapable. No matter what, we're always applying creative interpretation onto these stories. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a disconnect there by kind of trying to pretend that we're not doing that and that we are watching some sort of truth. And maybe that also contributes to why we get behind movies like this, because we feel like, I think I've said this maybe in our first couple episodes about, like, I'm doing something good. I'm learning something. I'm contributing to society, when all you're doing is staring at a screen and watching, you know, people make believe that they are people who once did something good. You're so far removed from the original thing.
I think that a movie like this, though, that does have a clear message of, you know, humanizing the gay movement, the gay rights movement, I think it accomplishes something there.
Yeah,
I think that when you walk out and you think, like, I mean, hopefully you're not going in hating gay people and then walking out, you know, hopefully you don't walk into anything hating people. But anyway, I think that this movie was probably made specifically with that in mind.
The last line, something social, like, you got to have hope. I mean, if you're closing your movie with those words. Anyway, so going back to the this question about how much do people like biopics? My question to you is this a movie do you think that you want to or will ever watch again? And if not, what does that say about the movie?
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever watch it again. I mean, I didn't feel like I had to wrestle with anything emotionally, and there wasn't anything aesthetically that I feel like I've got to see that again. So it was, you know, it's not in my top 10 movies of the year, but,
Cause we've talked about rewatchability before as one possible criterion for what makes a movie
for sure
great with a capital G. Mm-hmm. And I always kind of think of it as rewatch. I've always had a sort of a problem with the rewatchability thing, because to me, it's like, that means that the movie must be fun or that it's quotable. And I don't really value it in that way so much. I think about, like, There Will Be Blood or In the Bedroom. Those are not fun movies at all, but they were way more rich to me the second time that I watched them. So that tells me that they're loaded with something that's sort of rewarding to unpack. Mm-hmm. So I need that, you know,
As far as rewatchability, I mean, I agree. You got to have a need to go back to it.
Either some sort of ambiguity or some sort of high level, craft or experimentation or something that I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah.
And if there's nothing there to figure out, then it's kind of a one and done situation for me.
Me too. There's a, I listened to a masterclass by Billy Collins, the poet, recently, and he interprets a Robert Frost poem and says, most people read it like this, but you can also, you know, if you pay attention, you could also read it to have this almost opposite meaning. And he said that is one of the reasons why it's a classic poem. Because you can do either one, and you can endlessly debate about what works. And it shows a high level of, you know, craft to be able to do that. And again, you're ending with complexity. If it sticks with you, makes you think more about, you know, your own life, lives of other people. It did make me think about the lives of other people. This movie did. Mm-hmm. But as far as, it's just kind of a simple ending. It's a simple message.
And still, mm-hmm. so many of these types of movies are the ones that are nominated as one of the five best pictures by the Academy.
I respect Peter Travers' opinion quite a bit. Yeah. It's like him and Rogers check their top 10 lists before I say, okay, I think I know all the movies I'm going to watch for that year. I always check their lists. And Peter Travers said this is an American classic. Mm-hmm. I didn't actually go and read the whole review. I don't even know.
What if the quote was, this is not an American classic?
I don't even know if in his review he had this exclamation point like it has on the front of the DVD cover. Hmm. He might not have. He might have had a simple period at the end.
You can't editorialize with an extra exclamation point. That's a no-no.
So here's a question about Sean Penn's performance. How good is Sean Penn in this? Do you feel like it's a Oscar winning performance? Is it a nomination to you? Is it a, this is where they got something wrong?
I was anticipating this one. I know that you like I thought you were going to compare it to Mystic River.
I thought about it for sure. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's a very different role, of course.
Yeah.
I certainly thought about Assassination of Richard Nixon, which also stars Sean Penn. What else have we seen on this show since
21 Grams.
Since he was 2000. In. I didn't see that.
I don't remember other ones that we've done on this show.
Yeah.
But I think it's a great performance. I definitely think that it's nomination worthy and probably better than Frank Langella, which you know I loved from Frost Nixon. I thought he was great.
I agree. It was better. There's more of a range of emotion that he's portraying. But there's one point that I think I didn't realize that I also felt this way until I read this critic saying this. Luke Davies of The Monthly mostly thought it was a moving movie and Sean Penn did great. But do you resonate with this at all? On a minor but troubling note, there are times when Penn's version of gay acting veers dangerously close to a twee version of his childlike, mentally retarded, acting in I Am Sam.
Oh, God.
Did you feel
at all? I never once thought that watching this.
I thought that some of the, you know, the mannerisms of Harvey Milk, maybe he was like that or even more. But like there's sort of like this, the gay flamboyance that I think he was trying to capture. I thought that at times I don't know. I kind of wondered if it was like going a little overboard with it. But again, I don't know. But I thought that. It occurred to me while I was watching it, and then to see him write that, I thought that was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. But again, it goes back to like, okay, there's the director, the choices of the writing and the facts. And now we always talk about, and the acting, like, are we impersonating? Are we acting? I think that he does just like Frank Langella does a really good job of a great acting performance that also happens to, you know, look like the real mannerisms. Actually, I don't know about Harvey Milk. With Richard Nixon, I think that's the case.
Yeah, I don't know about the mannerisms either. Maybe if we watched a documentary, sometimes we should have watched a documentary and did a little companion piece.
Sometimes that actually helps to not know the person, you know.
Yeah. I didn't ever feel like the flamboyancy was over the top or demeaning in any sort of way. I always felt like he was a pretty respectable guy.
Yeah.
And he does the thing where he smiles very, very big. Yeah. And you can tell that's a pen choice.
Yeah.
And so I felt like, and also the picture that we see of Milk at the end, he's doing that same
big expressions.
Yeah. That expressive toothy smile. And that kind of felt like the impersonation part, but the rest of it felt lived in and human to me. So I Am Sam. That's a rough comp.
This is another, this is a happy flashback ending.
Yeah. Again, yeah. Right? You brought that up with Cloverfield and a few other ones. Yep. And so I didn't notice it when it popped up here. I was like, Brian's not going to like this.
I don't think it's a bad thing. I've noticed it watching all these movies, you know, that's a trend, you know, a movie that has especially in true stories, you can't end it with a happy ending because the guy dies, you know, and it happens all the time. Like Cloverfield, you know, that's a true story. Just kidding. But you know, it's a real life tragedy. And then if you don't have the happy flashback, then people are walking out thinking that's a total downer. If you have a happy flashback, then people feel a little bit like
it's bittersweet though, right? Because
it is bittersweet. It makes it more complex of an ending, which I like. I think it's a good device, honestly.
Yeah, me too. It's a memory of simpler times, which make it seem almost like the road that we took to get here destroyed everything that we had before when things were simple and good. So
not only that,
it's
but
kind of a sad ending.
Not only that, but when you flash back, it kind of gives this like illusion of the passage of time. It almost like makes it your memory. And so when you're thinking back on that and you realize, they didn't even know what was ahead. It makes me reflect on my own life sometimes, you know, you think, maybe I shouldn't be too upset about the problems I have now because, you know, things are totally different later on.
And you see the makeup changes too. He looks a little bit younger in the earlier scenes, which you don't realize as the movie's going on.
I thought this was like Boyhood where he actually did it.
Yeah, they filmed it over the span of 15 years or whatever.
Probably couldn't do that for the 20 million.
No.
All right. I have a third question for you.
Okay.
Are you out of questions?
Mm-hmm.
Josh Brolin, according to Josh Brolin, who, by the way, I mean, I mentioned this already, but he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. it didn't blow me away, but I think Josh Brolin is good in pretty much everything I've seen him in.
Yeah, so same.
I don't have a problem with him. But the scene where Dan White, his character, is in his underwear looking scared through the window was not scripted like that, but was just the result of actor and director trying different things to convey his paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking about other, you know, great tidy whitey scenes in movie history.
Mm.
So I was wondering, you know, these, putting that one aside, I don't think that's one of the greatest, but let's think of these four tidy whitey scenes and tell okay. me what you, where you would rank these.
Okay.
I'm gonna include Bryan Cranston. You know, I have not watched.
Well, so far, he's rocketing up to number one. I'm gonna tell you that right now.
I have not seen. I've only seen like the pilot of Breaking Bad. I know I know that's a criticism that you have of
me. It's a huge mistake.
I'll get to Breaking Bad eventually. I think it's got filters. So Bryan Cranston, it's an honorable mention because he's not in the movies, but it's a show, which usually means it's worse than a movie.
Well, typically. So far he's number one. Go on to the next one.
Michael Keaton and Birdman.
I'm going Cranston.
Extended, 20 minutes of tidy whiteys there.
It's true.
The hovering at the beginning is one of my favorite moments of, I don't know, it's one of my favorite movie openings, I would say, is Michael Keaton hovering in tidy whiteys in the air. Tom Cruise, Risky Business.
I've actually never seen. I mean, I've seen the scene.
You know what I'm talking
about. I've never
about.
Actually seen Risky Business
it's,
in full.
It's not, I don't know that it's really worth it. You know, those early Tom Cruise movies are a little hard to sit through, including Top Gun. Top Gun is, I think, even worse than Risky Business, in my opinion. And then I didn't remember this because I Googled, you know, best tidy whitey scenes in movie history. And this one came up that I didn't even remember that there were any tidy whiteys in it.
Okay.
Michael J. Fox, Back to the Future.
Oh, yeah. Calvin Klein.
His mom, as a young, you know, attractive young lady, is in his bedroom when, of course, when he's there.
Keeps calling him Calvin because that's written on on the band of his underwear.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. So, okay. Bryan Cranston is number one for you.
All right. So I'm going to go Cranston because I have to. Calvin Klein, I'm going to go number two.
Michael J. Fox.
Now I'll go Birdman.
Okay.
And then the last one that you said.
Very good. Tom Cruise, Risky Business.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that kind of wraps up our most important, you know, parts of the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go on to a few bits of trivia. I got a couple things here. This is, one of them is just what might have been, basically. So this movie was on Gus Van Sant's radar since 92. He was signed on with Warner Brothers. So it didn't get made for 16 years. So it really could have been like a Sean Penn aging movie, really, if they wanted to. But the original choice was Robin Williams.
Okay.
Could see that?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, he worked with him in Good Will Hunting. So some continuity there.
Robin, I think Robin good. Williams would be great in this role. Other people that were considered, Richard Gere. You like that?
I haven't really seen Richard Gere display a whole lot of range. I think he's good in his little pocket, but I can't really think of a whole lot of big characters that he had.
Could you see Daniel Day-Lewis doing Harvey
Milk?
Yeah,
you know, Daniel Day-Lewis can do anything.
I think he would have a little bit more of a darkness to him. Al Pacino?
I don't know about that. At this time, 2008, I don't think so.
Yeah. Matt Damon was originally going to be Dan White.
Yeah,
I could see it too. Yeah, he kind of had to get scheduled out of it. But and then the last thing is the apartment that was used in the movie was the real apartment that Harvey Milk lived in. I kind of like that. Do you does that add to your estimation of the movie, or you think that that's pointless?
I think it's pointless. I mean, it's
why is
it's,
that pointless?
It's cool.
That's cool.
I guess. But
it's like, you know, people wore the same boots as somebody wore in real life in the movie, you know, things like that.
Yeah. I recently read that Jack Nicholson hates cheese sandwiches, but when he was filming The Shining, he ate only cheese sandwiches for like, I don't know, every day for a month just to make him agitated.
Yeah.
To be Jack Torrance and go crazy.
I love that idea.
It's so ridiculous.
You would never make it as a method actor.
I guess I wouldn't.
I mean, it's terrible. All right, keep it or kick it.
It's going to be a kick for me, pretty obviously. I do think it's solid, but I would even, I guess, recommend it to somebody. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say don't watch this movie. It's a solid one, but
yeah. What was your star rating on Letterboxd?
I'm waffling between a 3 and a 3.5.
Just go with a 3.25.
If I could, I would. That would
you
that
make
would be
the
perfect.
Rules. You could do that.
You can't do that.
You can't do
no,
that.
No, it only gives you the,
just
the
put
option
a,
to do
just a give it a 3 and then put in your review 3.25. So a couple other movies that help me to say, yes, I'm going to kick it, that are sort of crowding out some of these Best Picture nominees. I think I mentioned The Band's Visit previous episode. In Bruges, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You recommended that. Loved it.
Yeah.
Loved awesome. In Bruges. So good. Hilarious in a lot of parts, but so much tension.
You know,
life's at stake. Interesting, very small, tight cast in, you know, cool locations. You could tell it's kind of low budget, but it works really well. And there's great, you know, great ending. So anyway, I was very happy with that recommendation. And then Synecdoche, New York. Have you watched it yet?
Yeah.
You've watched it before. This is the second time?
I was looking forward to rewatching it, hoping that it would sort of click and I would be really excited about it and be like, yes, it's a top fiver. And it's, I don't think it's going to be a top fiver.
Yeah.
It is. I watched it right after I watched Doubt. So I had a little bit of a Philip Seymour Hoffman binge going on, which was great. I loved that.
Yep.
It really added something to my week. But the movie is just so insane. It's so insane.
It's hard to follow in a lot of ways.
I think it loses the thread a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe Kaufman works the best when he has a director who has a little sentimentality to him.
So tell me this. So Charlie Kaufman directed it. He directed, I think right before this was Eternal Sunshine, right? Did he do
he
one
didn't
in between?
That, no.
Yeah, he wrote that. Sorry.
Yeah.
But
I don't know if that was the one right before this. I think it might have been. But then, you know, being John Malkovich and Adaptation were there also.
So John Malkovich, 99, Adaptation in 2002. I loved both of those. They're both available on Clearplay. Eternal Sunshine is one of my favorite of the decade. And so I was so looking forward to this one. And yeah, it definitely goes so zany on me that it's hard to feel the emotion of it. But I think the middle of it, I was starting to feel like, oh no, this is not going to work. But I think that the last, you know, act helped me think that I want to rewatch it.
When he has the earpiece in?
Yeah. All that.
Diane Wiest is talking him through and kind of controlling everything in his life.
It starts to come back together for me. So I would definitely rewatch the movie. And in that sense, like, I think, well, maybe it's worth, I think it's a top 10 movie for me for the year.
It'll be for me.
Whether it's in the top five, I think it'll be competing, but I don't know if it'll really make it.
And it's kind of a perfect, not a complimentary piece, but just a comparison piece to this, because Synecdoche has so much rewatch value.
Yeah,
what's the word?
Rewatchability.
Rewatchability to it. Because you're trying to unpack it. You're trying to figure it out. It is just loaded with ambition, and it's weird, and it's non-traditional. And then this is on the other side of the spectrum, where you kind of know exactly what it's going to do from the beginning, and it does that, and it does it all well.
You know what?
So what's the more rewarding experience?
Yeah, I think even though like the emotion is kind of clearer in Milk, I think one of the, you know, I listen to the New Yorker fiction podcast a lot, and one thing I notice that they discuss and debate is, why do you think this character felt that way when this happened? Why did this character do that? Hmm. I think that there's that's what I come away asking in Synecdoche, New York. Like, why does Samantha Morton cry in that moment? Why does this person cry in that moment? Why are they laughing there and there? That's another thing that I really admire about Revolutionary Road. I know we differ.
We differ.
And I don't want you to say anything negative about it, because I want to leave it as a perfect piece in my mind.
Sure.
But the rapid reversal of emotion, that I think is challenging, you know, as you're sort of analyzing, like, why does Michael Shannon say that? Why does that cause this reaction to them? And when you have to really puzzle on it, but yet you believe the emotions, I think that is one mark of great movie making and great acting and great writing. So I think that there are a lot of things like that in Synecdoche, New York. Of course, doesn't hurt to have Philip Seymour Hoffman, a certified Best Picture this, good in everything, and Catherine Keener.
Yeah, I forgot that she was in this because she kind of hardly is, you know?
Yeah,
she
sort of
goes away very quickly, but it's an interesting watch, man, because it's one that I kind of want to like more than I do.
Me too.
I think it's very hard to connect to. It's incredibly abstract, but not really in a surreal way, just abstract. You know, it's visually abstract. The emotions are abstract. Everything doesn't really connect quite right.
Yep.
But it's sort of on purpose. That's what makes it.
I have a feeling that Charlie could explain everything in the movie to you if you wanted to. And that makes me think, okay, well, rewatching it, there's probably new things I would learn about it. And and those things could very well be valuable. I think he's saying some important things about aging and ambition and missing opportunities in life and things like that.
And kind of grappling with his own creativity and like, what is this urge to create something like it's going to save me? Like it's going to be the thing that leaves my legacy. What is a legacy?
Yeah.
How do you even do that? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, all that stuff is interesting and I'm glad that it's there. I just wish that there was, I wish there was a through line.
I'm going to watch it again and I'll tell you what the through line is when I'm ready. In the next episode, we will do Doubt. Oh yeah, I forgot. I was like, we should talk more about Doubt, but we're doing a whole episode about it.
Yes.
So just as a little teaser, it's nominated for 4 acting Oscars. Meryl Streep, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Amy Adams, and Viola Davis, and writing. So it's got so much to offer. So we'll look forward to that one next week.
I don't think I realized Viola Davis was nominated for one
scene.
Very
small part. Yeah. Very small part.
She does crush it though.
I mean, anytime that you have that much snot running down, you should get some kind of medal.
Yeah. Until then, find us on Spotify and social media. And for 16 years of Golden Takes, head over to Letterboxd/Mike Cavalieri.
To support the show and help select a movie for a future bonus episode, visit patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
Thanks to WNDF and the illustrious Mark Gilliland for producing. Also, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the show.
Thanks for listening to Best Picture This, the film criticism show marked by many mandatory scenes.